I'm sorry, but change is coming, whether you want it or not. So get prepared for it. That's my biggest bit of advice. It's definitely possible. It's been proven over and over again. So do the trials, commit to it, and you'll actually be really well prepared then when the legislation comes through.
Hi, I'm Kate.
And I'm Phil.
And this is The Underground, the podcast for garden sector professionals. Each week, we discover the trailblazers and innovators who are shaping the future of garden care in the UK. So, without further ado, let's get down and dirty. So welcome to the Underground Podcast. Today we are joined by Sally Nex, who is a gardener, has been a professional gardener, still is a professional gardener, is very much known as a gardening writer, horticulture writer, and is now working for the Peat Free Partnership, hosted by Plant Life. So welcome to the Underground, Sally.
Hi, Kate. Lovely to be here.
Welcome, Sally.
So Sally, can you tell us a bit about your background and what got you into the world of horticulture?
Well, I'm the classic kind of career change gardener me. I started out, in fact, in journalism. So I used to be a BBC journalist. I went straight into BBC journalism from university. And I spent about 15, 16 years, something like that, working in lots of different bits of the BBC news kind of family. So worked for a while in World Service Radio and television, and also Radio 4 and the 9 o'clock news, as it was then, as in TV 9 o'clock news. So I had a really, really interesting time there. But then I had kids, and that meant I couldn't work kind of antisocial news shifts anymore. So I was kind of the BBC did their best to sort of accommodate me. Bit tricky. I went into a kind of a 9 to 5 job, which was absolutely fine. But to be very honest with you, I really missed the whole kind of news thing. So anyway, so I started to look around me, and the only other thing that I did that I really loved was gardening, and I had always gardened. So that was the only other thing that I could think of that I wanted to continue to do and to do as a new career. So I was already trained technically, because I'd already taken my RHS level 2, but I went on to do level 3 down in Bicton in Devon. Basically that was it. And I started work as a gardener, just a self-employed gardener, really. Then it wasn't long, really, before my journalistic background kind of caught up with me in a way. And people started asking me to write about gardening as well. So that became the other half of my career, really. I was a gardener and a garden writer for a very long time. So that's how it all started.
Right.
Fascinating. So you've said you are a garden writer and a gardener, but you're very much known as an environmental gardener. You've written books and many articles on this, especially looking at low carbon gardening and self-sufficiency. So can you tell us why this has been at the heart of your horticultural career?
Well, it's all to do, isn't it, with the reason why you garden in the first place? Because people garden for all sorts of different reasons. Some people garden because they want to grow the biggest dahlia ever. Some people garden because they want to, outdo the neighbours in terms of the beautifulness of their gardens. Some people garden, because they want a work of art outside their back door. There's lots of different reasons why people garden. I gardened because I grew up in the countryside, and because I love nature, and because I love insects and birds as well as flowers, and I love plants too. So the reasons I gardened were environmental from the start. It didn't occur to me to start spraying bugs or anything like that. And although, you know, there were things that I did then which were not things that I would do now, perhaps, things like using plastic pots and all that kind of stuff. Right. Really, it was all about, I was just instinctively somebody who gardened in a very green way. I was always organic. I always avoided spraying. I, I, I was actually, by accident, I was peat-free from the start as well, because I just happened to pick up one of what must have been the first peat-free compost to be made. But anyway, so I've never gardened with peat-based compost, but I can't really claim that that was an environmental choice consciously, because it was purely by accident. But anyway... and the whole thing about growing my own food became an environmental choice as well, because I was uncomfortable with buying my fresh food from the supermarket or from the grocers, where it, generally speaking, was not raised organically, not stuff I could afford anyway. And so it was obviously sprayed and so on. I needed to know what happened to my food between when it was sown and when it was on my plate. And as climate change started to bite, and I started to realize things like the carbon impact of my food, growing my own food became even more important, and it tastes better, and it's really satisfying to harvest it yourself and things like that. So there's lots of different aspects to that. So my gardening started out as being ornamental, but actually very quickly I switched to edibles within, I was growing my veg from, I've been growing veg for over 20 years now, 25 years, actually, I would say. So I've been growing vegetables for a very long time now. And increasingly, that has also become a political and environmental choice too.
Right, right. Well, that sort of leads us neatly onto what you're doing now with the peat-free partnership. Can you just explain a little bit about what the partnership is all about and how you've got involved with them?
Yes, of course. Peat-Free Partnership hasn't been around for very long. We only formed towards the end of last year. So we are basically a really wide-ranging coalition of lots of different organisations. So as well as NGOs, the we've got all of the main ones like Wildlife Trust and the RSPB, Plant Life, of course, and they've all joined together, but along with horticultural organisations. So Garden Organic is involved. The RHS is involved. We are hoping, and we're actually in the process at the moment, of widening out to include botanic gardens and peat-free horticultural organisations of every size and shape, as it were. So we are quite a wide-ranging organisation. It's partnership. It's an absolute partnership. But the sole aim that we have, the only thing that we want to achieve, is to make sure that there is legislation to end the sale of peat to horticulture in all four nations of the UK. So that's basically our raison d'etre. And we are doing all sorts of things to make that happen. Obviously, we're lobbying MPs and working in Parliament. At the moment, there's a bill making its way through Parliament just now. It's presented by Teresa Villiers, the former Environment Secretary, and it's a very good comprehensive bill. It has lots of support, and the government does still say that it's committed to legislating to ban peat sales by the end of this parliament. But as we all know, time is running out. So we are trying to get government to sort of to back the bill and to try and support it and get it through in whatever way possible. But to be honest, if the next general election comes around and we end up with another administration, we will keep going with whatever party ends up in government next in any case. So so we're doing that. We're also campaigning, obviously, in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland too. And we are also trying to help the industry to make the transition smoothly and without hitches. And we're just kind of facilitating things like training and knowledge exchange. The fact that the RHS is involved with the partnership is brilliant, because they are doing the only wide-ranging nursery-scale trials in terms of working out what you need to do to be able to produce commercial level, very good quality plants in peat-free compost, that, you know, and make that transition. They've already, I mean, there are so many nurseries that have actually done that already. There's Greenwood Plants down in Sussex, which is now producing 6 million plants every year, completely peat-free. There's Seant Nurseries up in North Wales, which produces about 1 million plants peat-free every year. And of course, there's lots and lots of little nurseries as well, which are 100% peat-free. In some cases, they've been peat-free for decades. So it's clearly possible, but the trick is to work with the industry who are very used to growing in peat-based compost, and just kind of help them to access those strands of knowledge to do with things like watering and feeding and so on.
Right. Yeah. So there's been the perception that the garden industry has actually been quite slow to embrace the change to peat-free. Would you say that you have a bigger understanding now of the difficulties for leaving peat, or do you feel it's all about excuses?
It's a bit of both, really. I think that in some cases, there's just a massive reluctance to change. And I kind of understand, I get the reasons why, because when it's your business and it's your livelihood, and indeed quite often it's been your parents' livelihood before you, and you know, there's a lot riding on it. And if you suddenly switch to an unfamiliar growing medium, I can understand how scary that might be, and how the fact that, you know, it's a big risk. It's a massive risk to take. However, that's no reason not to try. And you can do on nursery trials and stick with them. I know lots and lots of nurseries are now starting small scale trials, but quite often, unfortunately, there's a lack of connection, I think, between those small scale trials and the larger scale trials, which are actually coming out with sort of very good results. So in other words, it is being proven now that you can do it. If you have tried it just the once, you've tried perhaps treating your peat-free plants in exactly the same way as you've always treated your peat-grown plants, and surprise, surprise, it doesn't work, then it's not that the peat-free compost is at fault. It's that you need to keep trying, and you need to keep trying different ways of doing it. Plug in to the knowledge base that is now being built by the RHS on this. It is online. It is very accessible. They've put everything out there. And all you have to do is go and look it up. There's lots of training courses being run. There's workshops being run by the RHS. There are in Wales, Lantra is starting to train local growers. There's lots going on if you want to plug into it, but it needs commitment. It is quite possible to do it. Greenwood Plants, again, they started switching to peat-free at the beginning of 2022. They were at the time, I think, about 60 or 70% peat-based, and they managed to make that transition within 2 years. By the end of 23, they were 100% peat-free, and they produced 6 million plants a year. Now, if they can do it, anybody can do it. So that's not to say that it's necessarily a straightforward thing to do. You do have to adjust everything that you do, from your watering regimes to your nutrition regimes to how you assess something and whether it needs watering or not, or everything. Also, what you find is that you will have to trial different brands of peat-free compost, simply because something that might suit one nursery and their types of plants and their ways of growing may not suit another. So it's really worth just getting out there and committing to proper trials. What they are saying at the moment is that the ones who are now trialing comprehensively and are committed to actually making that transition are the ones who are not going to find it difficult when legislation comes in. Right. It's going to be straightforward because they'll be pretty much already there. Yeah. But the ones that are going to have the trouble are the ones who stick their heads in the sand and who don't do anything about it, hope it goes away, hope there's no legislation, and just stick with the peat-based compost because that's what they've always done. I'm sorry, but change is coming, whether you want it or not. So get prepared for it. That's my biggest bit of advice. It's definitely possible. It's been proven over and over again. So do the trials, commit to it, and you'll actually be really well prepared then when the legislation comes through.
Excellent advice.
That is great advice. You've talked very much about growers. If I'm talking about the whole industry, without the companies manufacturing compost, there is no compost for the growers to use. So have you seen the kind of obstacles in persuading the industry that is manufacturing compost to make the changes to embrace peat-free?
Well, actually, if anything, growing media manufacturers are going faster than growers. In that they are all now producing their own peat-free ranges. Some are a lot better than others. I will tell you that for a start. Some of them, I struggle a little bit to basically the people who are historically peat extractors and who have built their businesses on peat-based compost, there are lots of parallels here between the experience of growers as well, but they are the ones who are finding it most difficult to produce good peat-free compost because it's not what they used to. Yeah. The really successful compost manufacturers that are really breaking through and actually making big inroads into the industry are the ones who've always been peat-free. Yeah. So we're talking about the Melcourts and the Rocket Grows and the Petersfields and Classman Diamond. They're obviously German, but you know they're the ones who have again, totally committed to peat-free. And that's their business. That's what they do. And they do it brilliantly. Melcourt, for example, will adjust their mix. If you're able to give them an order for a specialist plant range, they will adjust their mix for you. They are absolutely tuned into the industry. They really are. They're wonderful. And they are, as long as you use it well, in other words, you do all the adjustments to watering and feeding that I was talking about earlier. As long as you do it well, then those composts are as good as any. And I think because they've always been committed to the sort of peat-free journey, it's not even really a journey for them. That was how they started. Yeah, then they do it incredibly well these days. So I think that given that those are the industries that are up and coming, they are generally speaking based on circular economies. So they're doing things like, you know, Melcourt arose from a timber processing company, which was wondering what to do with its surplus wood finds, which is the kind of waste wood that you get from like shaving. It's not even shavings, actually. It's kind of wood shreds, as it were. And the obvious thing to do was to set up a gardening compost company. And bingo, look what that's given them. So the things like that, that they seem to arise from the need to recycle something, an organic matter of some sort, and they fold it into a compost and off they go. And that's a really successful business model.
Right. Interesting. You know, a lot of these bigger companies have spent years researching and developing peat-free, and there's no regulation out there. And there's a huge discrepancy in the quality of the different composts. We've talked about the Rocket Grows, the Melcourts, who started out peat-free, but how do you think we can resolve this problem with quality? I know that some of the bigger companies want there to be regulation. Do you see that as a way forward, or would that kind of make it difficult for the smaller guys to kind of break into the market?
Well, I don't think it matters what size it is. It's difficult to test compost, basically, whatever the size of your company. We are really supportive of a standard, of a kite-style standard mark for compost, so that you have a compost that's produced to a certain quality. Because, to be honest, it does everybody harm to have bad peat-free compost on the market. Because Absolutely. If there's genuinely bad peat-free compost, you're doing everything else right and still the compost is letting you down, then that gives peat-free compost across the board a bad name. It makes people less likely to use peat-free compost going forward. Mm-hmm. It just makes everybody's work a lot harder. So very much in favour of some kind of a standard mark for peat-free compost. However, it is really difficult to test peat-free compost batches in the same way as you would, a bicycle or, a drill or something like that. You know what I mean? Because you're not producing the same thing every time. Batches change, the ingredients change, lots of things. Peat-free compost itself is a live product. It's very changeable. So in order to be able to produce some sort of a standard, you actually need to do assays, bioassays, for every batch of compost. And can you imagine how impractical that would be? Yeah. So they are still working on a way of ensuring a kind of a standard, a quality mark for peat-free compost. But it is a very, very difficult process. We are very supportive of those efforts, though. Right.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but in the meantime, it's time for Kate's Corner, where we discover the musings and sage advice from the Gardener Guru. So, Kate, something a little bit different this week. You were on the Plant-Based Podcast the other day with Michael Perry and Ellen Mary Webster, talking about the very same subject that we're talking with Sally about this week, peat-free.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was great. It felt a bit weird being on the other side, as it were, you know, being the one asked the questions. But, you know, they're great to talk to. They're very knowledgeable. But what is interesting that you've got two people who are, as I said, knowledgeable into horticulture, into their gardening, but still they learnt a lot of things about peat-free and about the whole peat industry that, you know, many people don't know. So I think, yeah, do have a listen, because I think you might have your eyes opened a bit. But it's quite fun to be called the Queen of Compost too.
Absolutely. I thought you were great on it, Kate. I thought you were really good fun to listen
shucks.
To.
Thanks, Phil. Yes, I think Sally definitely is the more serious side, and maybe I take a bit more of a light-hearted, but also, you know, hopefully it comes across as knowledgeable, because yeah, I've been working with compost for many years. So yeah, if you want to find out absolutely everything to do with peat-free, as well as listening to this chat we're having with Sally next, do go over to the plant-based podcast feed and have a listen to my episode there.
Absolutely. It's a great podcast, and we thoroughly recommend you listen to that one as well.
Shameless plug there, shameless plug.
Thanks, Kate.
Thank you, Phil.
And back to the show. Sally, you were talking earlier about the work that you're doing with the peat-free partnership and the lobbying and campaigning you're doing to try and get the bill through Parliament. How do you think, if that bill doesn't come to fruition and the legislation isn't passed, how do you feel that we can persuade consumers to make that switch without being told that they have to?
Well, you see, that's why we need legislation, because if you don't tell people they have to, there will always be some who don't. Yeah. There will always be a motivation there for people to keep using peat, for people to keep producing peat products. And so we do actually really badly need legislation in order to just be able to draw a line under this, you know, and to make a level playing field too, to make sure that everybody is working on the same rules and within the same parameters. But in terms of sort of persuading people to use peat-free compost or to make that switch, a lot of amateur gardeners are already very engaged. Yeah. I give lots of talks to gardening clubs all over the Southwest. When the subject of peat-free almost always comes up. What I find is it's never, I hate peat-free and I'm never going to use it again. It's more, I've given peat-free a try, hasn't quite worked for me. What am I doing wrong? How can I do it better? Okay. It's, people are very committed to this idea of giving up peat in gardening. I think that they don't like the fact that there's peat in their compost. They don't like the fact that they're having to rip up peat bogs and ruin biodiversity, release all that carbon as well. Because we all know about carbon sequestration and its importance in fighting climate change these days. Absolutely. That message has very much got through. I think that, there are always going to be a few more traditional gardeners, you might say, who will always insist that peat is best. But that I am finding just in my contacts, I suppose, with gardeners day to day, is getting less and less the case. Most people I speak to use peat-free these days.
Right. Is that a generational thing then that you see?
Definitely. All of the, and this applies to growers as well, actually, the youngsters coming through are almost always doing it for environmental reasons now. Lots of them are growing food, actually, rather than ornamentals. That's another thing to sort of worry about. I don't know. Youngsters will grow houseplants, but not so much kind of, well, this is a terrible generalization, of course, I have two young daughters, and so I come across lots of young people who, of course, because of my job, feel that they need to talk to me about gardening, which is very sweet. But generally speaking, when they say gardening, they mean houseplants, because most of them are in rented accommodation and things. So that's a young people's thing. That's an introduction to what you might call gardening, but they go from there, generally speaking, to growing their own food, or a lot of them do. So food growing is another reason why youngsters get into gardening. I don't hear so many youngsters doing the whole ornamentals thing. But in terms of growers, the young growers coming through are also coming into it for environmental reasons. They cannot understand why people continue to use peat. They try as far as they can to reduce things like pesticides and so on as well. It's very much an environmental movement, and it plays into that side of young politics, if you like. Which is not to say that there aren't any who are coming in on the traditional side, but fewer and fewer. And I think that that's definitely, in my experience, that's definitely where it's going, without a doubt. And the more traditional gardeners just tend to be the older ones as well. That may be a generalisation, but I don't think it's much of one.
No, I think you're right there. Sally, we've already mentioned that you don't really see that there are challenges to growing in peat-free, which, you know, I would agree with you on that one. But do you have any top tips for making that change, for growing in peat-free compost, if you're someone who's been used to peat-based growing media?
Sure. If you're trying to make the transition, then the first thing to do is to make sure that you buy the right brands, by which I mean the market leading brands. You will come across loads of stuff on social media and on websites and things like that, which are comparing and contrasting the different brands. So don't just pick up the cheapest thing that you can find from your garden centre. I mean, I had a question after one of my talks, actually, where he said to me, you know, I've tried this peat-free compost, he said, and I've not been able to make anything grow in it. And I said, well, what brand are you using? And he said, I don't know. And I said, well, that's where you're going wrong. Because as long as you are using one of the good brands, and there are many more of them these days, some of them, like, you know, Miracle-Gro, for example, is 100% peat-free now. And that is a very recognisable brand that lots of people will have been using for years and years. So give those a go. Make sure that when you're watering, you water little and often. You don't soak your pot so that the water's running out from the drainage hole, because if you do that, you're basically watering out all the nutrients in the compost. So you will make it nutrient deficient very quickly if you do that. Yeah. So water little and often, and also start feeding with a liquid feed pretty much as soon as you pot up. The feeding is really important with peat-free compost as well. You mustn't shirk that, because if you leave plants in peat-free compost without any nutrients, they will quite quickly start yellowing and stop growing. The other thing to be aware of is that peat-free composts quite often, because they contain a fair bit of wood fibre and so on, they can look really dry on the top while they're actually really quite soggy underneath. So when you're watering, if you're, you know, not sure that it's dried out, one way to find out is to lift up the pot, and if it feels light, then it needs watering. You can also, of course, stick your finger in the top and just feel how it is underneath. But just be aware that that top layer can look very dry when actually the compost is perfectly damp.
Brilliant. Good tips there.
Yeah, all really good tips. Yeah, definitely. Sally, with the work you're doing with the Peat Free Partnership, do you consider the sustainability of the ingredients that are being used in these new peat-free formulations? And how do you ensure that you're not just swapping one environmental problem for another?
It's so important, this. There are many ingredients, like, for example, coir, which also has it may not be peat, but it also has a very high carbon footprint. The other problem with coir too is that it, in order to be able to process it, you have to, I understand, wash it with lots of fresh water in an area of the world, i.e. South Asia, where fresh water is quite at a premium for people. So, you know, I don't really want people to be using their fresh water to be making plant pots for me. I'd much rather that they, or indeed compost ingredients for me, I'd much rather that they used it, you know, for themselves. So there's lots of problems with ingredients like that. At the Peat Free Partnership, we are very, very supportive of a circular economy. So what we're talking about is that composting and making compost, making growing media, can actually really feed in to the benefits of having a circular economy that relies on recycling. Because, of course, most of the ingredients that go into a peat-free compost are recycled ingredients. So we're talking about waste wood, waste bark, you know, all of those kinds of things. So they are very much things which would otherwise be thrown away. Green waste, of course, where it's used, that's more problematic because of the various issues with things like contamination. digestate, you know, there's lots of things which are byproducts of existing materials, existing organic material use, which can also be used in compost. So if you can encourage those kinds of ingredients, they come in with a low carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. There is also, of course, the RSS scheme, the Responsible Sourcing Scheme, which is a really good initiative. It's terribly complicated, so it's finding it very slow to get up on its feet. But the idea is that eventually you'll be able to look on the back of a bag of compost and you'll be able to see a rating, a sustainability rating, because all of the ingredients in that compost, whatever they are rated according to their actual sustainability. So it means that if you've got a compost that is rated A or B, you know that it's very sustainable and very good all round. Obviously, as you go further down the scale, then it becomes less and less and less sustainable, peat being the least sustainable ingredient of all. So that's a very good scheme. The only difficulty being that each different brand has to have itself audited, very long and complicated process, and they're finding it quite hard to get those marks onto the back of all of the compost bags that there are in the garden centre. Right. But, you know, that's coming down the line. So that will be very useful when it comes properly on stream. Otherwise, I think, you know, as I say, peat-free compost itself is a really good way of encouraging lots more recycling and more for that.
Yeah, excellent.
We did actually have Steve Harper from the RSS talking to us a few weeks ago about the scheme. So, yeah, it is interesting to hear your take on it as well. Thank you.
Yeah. You've already mentioned earlier about young people have a much more environmental, value-based approach to gardening. Where do you see the future of sustainable horticulture going?
It's really bright, actually. I get such joy from organisations like Harriet's Plants down in Cornwall. She's just producing lots and lots and lots of wonderful peat-free houseplants. She's doing a cracking business, actually, and she's mostly working on Instagram. She does, look up her videos, actually. She does lovely little short videos of her dancing, and she's got a baby, and it's just adorable. That's a real new model for horticulture. She doesn't go to shows. She doesn't have... I think she has a website, but she certainly doesn't have a physical shop. It's a very, very low key, sort of low impact kind of business. Now, obviously, she's very small, and a lot of these businesses are, but they're small, they're local, they're sustainable. And it's about how you feed in from those kinds of models into a larger scale industry, if you like. Even at a larger scale, all the youngsters who are coming in with new ideas and new ways of doing things, and they're starting to change things from the bottom up as well. They don't even need to be all that young. It depends where you stand in the kind of age scale, as it were. You know, people in their 30s and 40s are starting to come into mainstream, high-end, big-scale horticulture now, and they are starting to change things, not just here, but also on the continent. You're starting to get people working for big wholesalers in the Netherlands now. There is a campaign which involves only young people, actually, in the Netherlands, which is campaigning for getting peat out of horticulture in the Netherlands as well. And those youngsters are starting to come into the wholesalers, who are now starting to bring out lines of peat-free plugs, because, as I'm sure you know, people buy lots of plugs into the UK, which are grown in peat. Now there are increasing ranges of peat-free plugs. There's an entire nursery which has brought out a big range of full-grown plants in peat-free from the Netherlands that you can import now. You know, there's lots of innovations, both in the UK and further afield, and they are being driven by people who are coming into the industry with their own agenda. And it is a relatively new agenda. It's been building for a number of years, but it is going to change absolutely everything. Absolutely everything. And it fills me with hope. It really does.
Oh, that's wonderful. It's so lovely to see you and hear you being so positive about the future. It's really encouraging. You mentioned there about Harriet's Plants, and you said that they're not they don't take part in the traditional shows and that sort of thing. We're talking to you at the time of the Chelsea Flower Shows, actually on at them this week. How do you feel that their attitude is changing towards sustainability? And, you know, what do you feel about the future of those big RHS type shows?
Well, I hope they continue. I am a little bit torn about big shows, big flower shows, because there is nothing sustainable about shipping a load of stuff into a small site in central London, keeping it there for just 1 week, and then shipping it all out again with all of the sort of fuel and the cement and the, you know, the very high carbon implications of that. However, having said that, the fact that the RHS has said that it wants to be peat-free by the end of 25 and it's making its exhibitors prove that they're peat-free in shows from that moment onwards has really driven change in growers. And it's meant that if growers want to continue exhibiting at RHS flower shows, and they are the biggest platform on which they can display what they're doing. If they want to continue that, they will have to go peat free. And so the money's the RHS is really putting its money where its mouth is and saying, you know, they may take a hit in terms of the number of exhibitors that are able to exhibit at their shows, but it is sending a really strong and clear message to the industry that if you want to carry on doing what you're doing, you will have to embrace this change. And I hugely admire the RHS for doing that. The other thing about shows is that they are also big platforms and they reach a massive audience, some of whom are not always aware of all of this stuff. And they are reaching a really big audience with lots of really strong sustainability messages. If you go and see gardens at Chelsea or Hampton Court or any of them these days, they will all have some sort of a sustainability environmental message nowadays. Absolutely. And that is really starting to get through. So from that point of view, shows have a really important role to play, but it's the actual sustainability of the shows themselves that troubles me, that's all. I really don't know where I stand on it. I think I'm going to sit on the fence very firmly, actually, because there's six and one and a half a dozen the other. I think that they are both a good and a not so good thing, perhaps.
Yeah. No, it's really tricky, isn't it? Because, you know, for example, the Chelsea show this year, there's a lot of the gardens have got like water conservation as part, you know, built into the show gardens, and they're trying to emphasize that part of sustainability. So showing people and being able and people becoming more aware of those things is great. But as you say, you know, the carbon footprint of just putting it at the show on is quite astronomical.
Yes, that's very true.
Yeah, I do. I remember just standing at the gate when I was building a show, and you're waiting for the lorries, and there are so many trucks coming through one after the other after the other, and they're all diesel trucks, and they're heavily loaded, and some have come from up north, from down the southwest. So there's a lot of miles being done in diesel to bring these sustainable.
It is absolutely enormous. Yeah.
Yeah, it is a tough one, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how you solve that, really, because, you know, how do you get that message across reliably without a platform like a flower show? I just don't know how you would do it in the way that flower shows are able to do. I don't think there's anything else that would do that.
Yeah.
Do you think social media is doing that a bit, though, especially with the younger generation? There's so much out there on social media about how to be more environmental, more sustainable. Do we need these flower shows, or is it a kind of vanity project for a lot of us if it's the younger generation?
Yeah, but I tell you what, though, the problem with social media is it's so hard to find your way through it, isn't it?
Oh,
there's loads of cowboys out there that are frankly giving you bad advice. Yeah. There's lots of people who are trying to flog something, or, you know, all sorts of things like that.
True.
It's there are a few really wonderful influencers out there who are doing brilliant jobs, you know, explaining more sustainable techniques. Charles Dowding, Hugh Richards, Stephanie Hafferty. There's lots of really, really good people out there on social media who are giving lots of good advice. But there are an awful lot more who are very much not. and so I find it quite hard to navigate it all. And if you're a beginner, if you're an absolute amateur, not quite knowing where to go, it must be particularly difficult, I would have thought.
So Sally, what keeps you working within the gardening sector, within horticulture?
Oh, do you know, I'm not sure that I would want to be anywhere else now, because I am doing every day, I'm doing something that I love, and I'm working with what I love. And how many people can say that? I am outside every day. I am working with plants every day. I am talking about plants every day. I am talking about things I'm passionate about as well, because, you know, the whole issue of the environment and climate change and all of that has become something which, as time has gone on, I've become, if anything, even more passionate about than I was before. And so it's everything to me, and I get to work in it. I mean, horticulture is one of those very few places where you can get to marry kind of work and pleasure in quite this way, if you know what I mean. You get to look at beautiful things all the time. You get to have your hands in the soil. You get to eat really well because you're growing your own food, and you get to talk about it. And I also love communicating, because, you know, I'm a journalist at heart, I suppose. And so it also means that I can also communicate some of that passion to other people, or at least I hope I can. And certainly it's very fulfilling to be able to do that.
Well, you certainly do communicate really, really well. And what I'm loving about our podcast, Phil, is I don't think we ask most people this question, and there's not one person that has said, well, actually, I'm fed up with it and I can't wait to get out of it and I wish I was doing something else.
Absolutely.
So the passion, I think, is across the board with so many people, which says a lot about our industry. We just need to get the government to understand quite how serious we all are.
Yeah, I think so.
So finally, Sally, I'm just going to ask, do you have a plant or flower that will always put a smile on your face, however you're feeling, whatever mood you're in?
Well, probably like most gardeners, it does depend on what season of the year you're asking me this particular question. The plants that put a smile on my face mostly are plants which are beautiful and usually also edible, and generally speaking, covered in butterflies and bees and stuff like that. At the moment, the thing that's making a smile is not strictly speaking edible, I suppose. At the moment, it's the big clump of sweet rocket that's just outside the door of my office, which is an absolute mass of flowers right now. And I was watching a brimstone butterfly on it yesterday, and just for about 10 minutes, I was just watching this butterfly fluttering around. And I thought, oh, it doesn't get much better than this. The sun was out. It was just lovely. So that was definitely putting a smile on my face.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Lovely. Thank you.
Yeah, well, Sally, I think that just about wraps things up for us today. I just want to say thank you so much for giving us your time. We've thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you and just getting your insight into peat free and how the industry's moving forwards has just been amazing. Really good. So thank you.
Thank you, Sally.
Well, thank you very much. It's been such a pleasure. It's been really enjoyable.
So, Phil, that was a really engaging conversation we had there with Sally. Goodness me.
Oh, and I mean, our listeners won't know this, but our conversation carried on afterwards, and that was very enlightening.
Yes, off the record, that one, Phil.
Well, maybe we shouldn't say that.
I quite like it. I think we should.
Yeah, okay.
There are just no excuses, are there, for not going peat free?
No.
And that's the bottom line. There are no excuses. It might be painful to start with, but no, yeah, there's no reason not to. And Sally, you know, has proven that. She's given us lots of growers who have been growing in peat-free. She's been growing in peat-free. I mean, I've been growing in peat-free. And I think with the election coming up now, there is no chance of the peat ban. That's not going to happen this year. But I just think on people's conscience, really, you need to be peat free, and we need the industry to be leading this. And it seems for us, Phil, within the garden industry sector, there are still people that are just biding their time and just hedging their bets, whereas really the best thing you can do is just embrace it and go peat free.
Exactly. Without a ban.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, we should probably say that the interview with Sally was actually recorded about 2 days before the general election was called. So, yes, mm-hmm. we were all hopeful that legislation would try and get passed before the autumn, but it really doesn't look like that is going to be a priority at all.
Yeah. Well, we just have to hope that whoever is in power does take a bit of time out to, you know, learn a bit more about horticulture and how important the industry is to the country and the economy.
Exactly.
And at the end of the day, we need people to grow food. We need plants. Without plants, you know, we won't survive. I'd rather have a horticulturist with me at the end of days than a solicitor or a lawyer, I have to admit.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Phil.
All right. Thanks, Kate.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, could I ask a small favour? Please take the time to review the show and share us with your colleagues. It really does make a difference and will help others to find us too. To keep up to date with the latest happening from the Underground, sign up to our email newsletter at theunderground.fm. I'm Kate Turner, the Gardener Guru. I'm a horticulturist, garden consultant, and presenter. To find out more, check out my website at gardenerguru.co.uk.
And I'm Phil Wright, the founding partner of Wright O'Barra, a creative marketing agency specialising in the home and garden sectors. And for anyone bringing a new product to market, we've created a handy 7-step guide to help take your product marketing from zero to hero. Find out more at wrightobarra.com.